Now, across Australia this weekend, there are many nervous, excitable households. Final year students at many schools around the country have already broken up. Formals have been held. There have been tears, and you hope there have been quite a few good times as well. After 12 or more years of preschool and schooling, only the dreaded final exams now stand between those. How quickly they grew up, children, and all the imagined pleasures and freedoms of young adult life. Now, Dr. Bryony Scott has seen it all before. Once again this week, she was waving off another cohort of girls as principal of the elite Sydney Girls' School, Winona. Bryony Scott, welcome to the year that made me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Were there tears?
Oh, yes. Yes, tears on behalf of the teachers, the students and the parents.
You are the principal of a girls' school. When you look at your girls leaving now, 17, 18 years old,
yes,
with their final exams and then for many of yours off to university, what is your feeling about their prospects, broadly speaking, girls in 2019 Australia?
There's a part of me, particularly the way I educate young women, which is that I raise them for egalitarian leadership. I raise them to understand that they have the ability to be able to determine the outcome of their life. They can't affect what happens to them, but they can certainly affect how they react to what happens to them. So in one sense, I go, they are more empowered, I suspect, than they have ever been. I think young women in Australia are the best educated women in history. So they have a lot going for them in that respect. I think these are complex times because there's equally a pushback against women, women who stand up, women who engage in leadership, particularly in this country. It is not a given that they are treated equally at all. And it's very easy for arguments around women to be debased very quickly.
And so the argument that is being made that, say, women are getting a fast track into C-suites or onto boards because everybody is, we've got to get women on the boards, we've got to get women on the panel, we've got to women, you know, because it doesn't look good if we don't have more women in the executive row.
Yes.
So this is the counter argument that gets made, in fact, is that women are getting an uplift into all these places.
I think that's a very simplistic response. There is a wonderful quote, I think by Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., that says, I wouldn't give a fig for simplicity on this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And what that means is it's very easy to come up with really simple binary arguments or comments that actually don't engage in the complexity of the issue. Why is there still a gender pay gap? Why, particularly online and with social media, are we really struggling with women in this kind of environment?
Your school, Winona, is a very, it is an elite school. I think we can reasonably say that. It's a Lower North Shore of Sydney school. The fees, in fact, I went to look at them up on your website and I couldn't find the fees. Yeah. You have to contact the school.
Very wise, yes.
It feels a little bit like the old line about a Rolls Royce. If you have to ask the price, you can't afford it. Do you think privileged girls, it might seem an obvious question, have an advantage over those without a private school education?
Many of them are privileged. They're born into a situation where their parents can afford the fees to send them to the school. We work very hard as well in saying to these girls, with that comes enormous responsibility. It comes enormous responsibility to capitalise on the education because there are millions of women around the world, millions of young girls who don't have this kind of education. So what are you doing about that? It's not enough for you to come to our school and just go, well, aren't I lucky? You know, I have my life is paved in front of me. We are now particularly focusing on means-tested scholarships or scholarships for young women who would not be able to normally attend a school like ours. So we have students now who come from multi-generational unemployment. We have students who come from, who live in foster care and come and board with us during the term. We have girls who come who are on temporary protection visas. Yes, for some of them, there is a common factor around their parents' income. But equally, the highest rates of domestic violence that I have seen have been in the schools that I've worked on in the Lower North Shore.
Really?
It doesn't. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't stop. Control comes in funny ways and money's one of them, but, you know, it doesn't stop the dad who gets cancer. It doesn't stop the mental health issues that are prevalent in you know, so many of our families.
Just briefly, girls.
Yes.
And co-education, you know.
Yes.
Being taught with boys or being taught just with girls.
Yes.
What works best?
It all works. So I have taught in co-ed, I have taught all boys, I have taught all girls. I'm a specialist in girls' education, I'm a specialist in raising young women.
Are you sitting on the fence there a little bit?
No.
Because there is some evidence, isn't there, about
Works? There are wings of libraries devoted to this topic.
And on the balance of that evidence and what you know, what works generally best for girls?
What works best is when you have leadership that recognises that there is gender inequity. And once you recognise that and you work towards addressing that, then you can actually do that in an all-girls school. You can technically do it in an all-boys school. You can do it in a co-ed school. One of the challenges we have often in co-ed schools is we're so busy proving how equal we are, we don't recognise that there are, in fact, biases that are taking place. You can have an incredibly sexist all-girls school and you can have an incredibly sexist all-boys school. So it really comes down to the awareness of the leadership as to what they're how conscious they are that inequities exist. Now, gender is one inequity. There are other inequities that take place too within schools where education, for example, education, our system, rewards conforming extroverts. So if you have a slightly outgoing child who plays by the rules, they tend to love school. If you have an introvert who is perhaps a little, you know, plays outside of those lines, school can actually be very difficult. The problems with school, of course, is that they're very narrow conveyor belts and life is incredibly rich and wide and school is quite narrow and compliance driven. And so it's very easy for us to go, those students who fall outside of those tracks, there's something wrong with them, there's a problem, and there's nothing wrong with them at all. They are born the way they're born. They're magnificent people. They need to get a quality education as well. But it's easy within school environments for those young people to feel like they're sidelined.
So do we sausage factory our kids too much?
I don't. But I think there's a risk for any human. And once again, I'm not hedging my bets here, but humans deal in stereotypes. That's what we do. We tend to categorise people according to different criteria because it makes it easier for us to relate to them.
You were travelling well and you got an unexpected diagnosis.
I did.
Tell us about that.
2015. I went to the doctor. I had a cough and I thought, I'm a bit slow to go to the doctor, but I went anyway and was tested for whooping cough, which it turned out to be. But the GP at that point said, look, why don't we just go and do a chest x-ray anyway? And I texted my husband and I said, if ever you needed evidence of rampant over-testing in the medical profession, this is it. This is ridiculous. But of course, went down to the doctor, had the x-ray, and the x-ray attendant came out and said, so are you a real doctor? But then realised pretty quickly that there's something was wrong. And I was diagnosed that evening with lung cancer.
Never smoked?
Never smoked.
Out of a clear blue sky?
Clear blue sky. But lung cancer is one of the most common cancers in Australia. One of the fastest growing rates is young women who've never smoked, and the death rate for it is incredibly high simply because there's such an enormous stigma around being diagnosed with lung cancer that there's just no money poured into research at all. So unfortunately, it's a very tough cancer to get.
How did that change your life and your view of life?
In the short term, I was engaged very much in treatment. So I had what I called the smorgasbord approach. You know, I had chemotherapy and surgery and radiotherapy. And I basically just said to them, I'm young, just napalm me, like do whatever you got to do to get rid of this. And the doctors were magnificent with that. Because I was a principal in a school, I was really cognizant. And also at the time, of course, Mark was here and my husband was here. And
your husband's Mark Scott, that time the head of the ABC.
And so it was a news story. Like we sent a letter out to the parents. And what I really needed them to do was to manage the grief. At that point, the school, I think, was about 1,100 students. They've each got two parents, you know, so the ripple effect was huge. So I sent a letter out and in that letter I said that, you know, you can't stop the stars that happen to you, the things that happen to you in their life. They're like the stars in the sky, but you can alter the constellation. You can alter the story around that. And I really needed the parents to walk alongside their young people and their children and help them make sense of what was a pretty formidable diagnosis, because I knew the first thing they'd do is Google it, right? And the death rate is so high that I knew that there would be a corporate grief.
You don't find that, even just what you're telling me there, to be a little bit extraordinary, or at least indicative, that in the middle of your own, what at that stage must have looked like a fairly dire prognosis,
you're busy
being an educator, trying to make it a teachable moment, for your kids, but for their parents and for their entire school community.
It wasn't so much that I was trying to teach them, because I don't know that I had the answers. I knew that I couldn't get to them, and I knew that they would be grief-ridden. And so I wanted to be able to get to them first and hear that it was going to be okay, even if it wasn't okay, that it was going to be okay. And I really needed the parents to do that because I couldn't get to their kids because it all happened really quickly from that point onwards.
You name 2016 as the year that made you. Why? What happened in 2016?
Well, 2016 was the year that treatment ended. And I realised at that point, you don't ever get a guarantee, you know, once treatment ends that everything's fixed. In fact, quite the contrary, it gets dragged out for years. You never quite know whether it's right or wrong or whether it's worked or not. But 2016 was the year that I realised that actually I had a really good life and I didn't want to kind of trade in husbands or have a sea change or do anything different. And it was also the year, I think, where when you go through something like this, you actually know that you will die now. Like you've absolutely faced your mortality. You know that you'll go. The question now is just a matter of when. And it does affect how you do life, knowing that actually there is an inevitability that I knew in theory prior to this point, but now I know in my heart that there is an end to this. And so you live life more deliberately.
And your song that you've chosen is, of course, the wonderful Louis Armstrong. It's almost redundant to ask, but why this song?
You know, I really love, not obviously his voice, and he's an extraordinary musician, but I love the simplicity of it because I think sometimes, you know, when we're talking a lot about, you know, mindfulness and all of these things that, you know, how do you de-stress, we make it so complicated. And what I love about this song is the simplicity that when you shake someone's hand, you're actually saying, I love you. When you spend time with them, you're saying, I actually enjoy your company. And it's that kind of simple message that they're not little events. They're actually significant and they're laden with meaning. And you're not overthinking it, but you're not minimizing it either.
It is by those little things that we live well. Here it is. Bryony Scott, so lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Louis Armstrong, It's a Wonderful World.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. And
that was Louis Armstrong there, of course. What a Wonderful World there, for a song for Dr. Bryony Scott, our guest for the year that made me.